Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host, Sam Moyne, and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. This is the first episode of season four. We do it by semester. I don't know why we do it, but at some point I decided we do it by semester. So this is season four. And this semester is notable. We've got a bunch of really great episodes coming up. We're going to play pundit. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about legal history. We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. We're doing it with Sam in England, which is pretty exciting. He's got a fun new accent. And if you can't see it right now, but he's wearing subfusc. it's going to be a real clam bake of a season. And we're starting off with a total banger. Sam, who's joining us?
David, we're going to test your personal allegiance to economic oligarchy by talking through the amazing new book from law professors Joey Fishkin and Willie Forbath. It's called The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, and we asked some probing questions of the authors, and it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you really, really stung it to me, this one. You had called me by one of the worst insults in the book during this episode, constitutional law professor. I may never forgive you. So with that, I will let's get to the episode. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're so excited to have Willie Forbath and Joey Fishkin with us on the first episode of our season four of Digging a Hole. Willie Forbath holds the Lloyd M. Benson Chair and is the Associate Dean of Research at UT Austin School of Law, and is also a professor of history at UT. He's the author of Law and the Shaping of the American Labor Movement, and honestly, more articles than you can count on labor law, legal and constitutional history and theory, comparative constitutional law, the history of Jews in the 20th century, left-wing lawyers, and honestly, about a million other things. There's so much to read in his work. Joey Fishkin is a professor of law at UCLA, where he teaches and writes about employment discrimination, election law, constitutional law, education law, fair housing, poverty, inequality, and distributive justice. His first book, Bottlenecks, A New Theory of Equal Opportunity, was awesome. We're not going to talk about it today, but you guys should all go out and buy it like yesterday. But we're really excited today to talk about Joey and Willie's long-awaited new book, The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of American Democracy, drops next month, and we get to talk about it today. So welcome to the pod, Joey and Willie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, needless to say, so many of us have been so excited that this has been imminent for a while. And now that it's coming out, it's not just long-awaited, but long. It's monumental. And it was a genuine privilege to read in advance of publication. And everyone, as David said, should read it. I want to start by, you know, just asking how you two came to write this. You were colleagues at University of Texas. Joey's moved on, obviously, but it's always interesting to hear, especially for co-authored projects, how something came to be. And with something monumental like this, I'm curious for our listeners to know the backstory.
Yeah, this was going to be a really short conference paper close to a decade ago. And it sort of outgrew that shell immediately. And we quickly realized we had a lot to say and it needed to be this book.
I've been working in this general area for quite some time. Alternative accounts over time of our constitutional order that spotlighted economic inequality. And one of the things that resonates is opportunity, right? As everyone knows, opportunity is a golden word in American political culture. Joey had just finished a book on opportunity. And while I'm an historian with some thoughts about theory, Joey's a theorist who was game to become an historian. So it seemed like a match made in heaven.
Well, it certainly looks that way on the other side for readers. So I wonder if you could, you know, in a sense, give us your elevator pitch. This is a historically unfolding account of what you call a tradition. The tradition has three strands, and you track them, you know, across the history of the Republic. And so I don't know, you know, how one could summarize this, but certainly you could mention the strands. and maybe tell us if you think it's worth attending to, you know, high points, you know, ruptures, whatever.
What's striking about the crisis of economic inequality today, as Joey and I see it, is that it's the first time in our history when only one side of the political spectrum is making strong claims on the Constitution. Only conservatives today believe that the Constitution has important things to say about economic life. And what's striking about all the many kind of moments of mounting inequality and mounting economic pain and anxiety for the Republic and for the ordinary member of the Republic, is that always all sides were arguing that the Constitution has much to say. And that's something that, you know, struck me again and again as I did much more close to the ground history, and history that was more social and less purely constitutional. But as we drilled deep into moments from sort of the founding onward, we were struck again and again by the unfamiliar ways in which lawmakers and reformers talked about the Constitution, not in terms of a big bundle of positive rights, but instead about the structure of the economy as being inextricable from the structure of the constitutional order as it should be.
So what we end up doing is tracing what we call a tradition. Obviously, it's got some internal complexities and conflicts, but it's a story of people who thought the Constitution had something to say about concentrated economic power. That is, if you're going to keep your republic, you need to have economic and political power more broadly distributed among all the people, which means you can't have oligarchy. That's where we get our title, the anti-oligarchy constitution. You need also to have a broad middle class, and you need that broad middle class to be inclusive across lines of race, especially, and other of those demographic lines. That's the version of this tradition that kind of comes together in Reconstruction, which is sort of the apotheosis of it from our perspective. And there are versions of it from that play a role in constitutional fights from the founding through the New Deal, and that then sort of drop away. So part of the story of our book is, why did it drop away, and why today then are liberals and even progressives so loath to talk about the Constitution in the way that their forebears did, as something that actually contains legislative obligations, things that we have to enact. And instead, we're trapped in this sort of court-centered way of talking about the Constitution.
All right. So that's a great entry for the kind of first question I want to ask. It's so convincing, but I'm going to renew a question I've asked Willie before in prior engagements. You know, I'm all in on the political economy part and the visions that you rehabilitate. And this is a great opportunity for us to gang up on, David, the neoliberal, which, it's harder to do when I don't have, two others on the podcast with me to do so. Where I'm still having trouble is the constitutional part of constitutional political economy. And as you say, it doesn't seem to have a lot of, that part doesn't have a lot of takers right now, because on the left, it doesn't seem like we ought to work within this constitution, or maybe constitutionalism, given the right-wing role it's played. And so let me just press you on why we should do so anyway. And your first answer seems to be, it's the substance of the book, is that some Americans before did so in ways that we ought to find appealing or uplifting or whatever. Some of that kind of, I worry, plays on a kind of ambiguity between, let's call it small C constitutionalism, that's really like the idea of like our regime commitments, and a big C constitutionalism that's about the written text, you know, the legal document that of which the right has made so much. But even apart from that, I mean, of course, it doesn't follow from the fact that people tried things in the past and usually failed that we should try again. And second, there's just like a kind of a normative political argument for ordinary politics, not constitutional politics. And, you know, in a sense, leaving our options open about where we go. So I guess, you know, other than the fact that we're con law professors, what do we get out of saying the left ought to pursue political economy through constitutionalism?
Yeah, this is a great question at the center of the project of the book. So I think the beginning of the answer is it's not true that you today or anytime can have one set of constitutional arguments in court and then a totally separate world of political arguments outside of court. Things flow back and forth very freely, and the right has made enormous use of that fact to use things that they can get their favored judges to say about constitutionalism in general, about the Constitution and political economy arguments against government, against redistribution, for what they see as liberty. They use those arguments in politics and use the fact that courts have said them to give them their constitutional politics power. So you can't seal it off. And it's true, Sam, that today a lot of people would say, well, isn't there sort of a difference between big C and small C constitutionalism, just like you said? And that's absolutely a true description of how a lot of people see things today. Our project is to resurrect a kind of constitutional politics that doesn't make that distinction, which we argue is kind of an anachronism when you project it back on most of American history. We think that it actually would be better to not have that kind of bright separation, which we think that conservatives have never particularly accepted anyway, but liberals are a little more attached to, and that instead we should sort of recognize that there's a continuity between constitutional arguments and political ones, and that there are a lot of good constitutional sources that are including text and including structural arguments that are that support progressive constitutionalism as well.
Also, we don't buy, there's another sharp distinction, Sam Drew, that we don't buy, which is ordinary politics are wide open and freewheeling and enable us to use our imaginations to sort of rethink every institution we're stuck with. And constitutional politics, by contrast, are confining and constraining. And that, I think, is in some ways, it's true. One's constrained to some version of democratic self-rule. But those constraints we welcome. By and large, we just don't buy the notion that constitutionalism is as it's practiced in our past and should be in our future is so darn constraining. One can put forward the most radical arguments for A, abolishing the Electoral College, right? Refashioning the Senate. All of this is part of our tradition. You know, Eugene Debs made these moves all the time. We want radical changes in the constitutional order, big amendments, in the name of the principles at the heart of the Constitution, and above all, in his case, the political economy principles about, you know, what a democracy requires in the way of economic arrangements. So it can be wide open because it's part of politics. It's not a limit on politics. It's not an order that, you know, we work within and that sets limits that courts will enforce if need be. Instead, it's what do these principles mean? Let's argue about it. In the electoral and in the political and social movement arena. And the right is doing all those things, and we think the left should too.
So I have a follow-up question, but before I say so, I want to register my disagreement and offense with something Sam said. I completely disagree with being classified in a group of people called constitutional law scholars. I've never been more offended. So I just wanted to put that out there. It's a completely inaccurate description of me. I want to see another critique, and to see how you think, what you think about of the idea of using constitutional politics rather than whatever the opposite of constitutional politics is, ordinary or other politics. And it's that it raises the stakes of politics too much and blinds people to compromise. So speaking in a constitutional register might lead people to be unwilling to do ordinary kind of somewhat gross compromises in the name of getting something done because the stakes are rhetorical stakes are so high. I mean, there's a reading of your argument that suggests that Democrats should kind of push the platform of their progressive caucus and kind of turn the volume up to 11. And there's a downside to turning the volume up to 11. And so in some ways you might say that there's a challenge, which you might be romanticizing dramatic politics, a desire to live in an exciting time over, I don't know, the slow boring of hard boards. And to make this less theoretical and more specific, I would say that like the current fight over the voting bill is a perfect example of constitutional politics in ordinary politics. So it's constitutional in both the senses you mean, that Joe Biden says it is a constitutional necessity. We must pass this in order to fulfill our constitutional beliefs in democratic self-rule. It's understood constitutional in the other sense you mean, is meant to shape the electorate. We're going to get a different electorate, so you use that constitutionalism in that sense. And it's the rhetorical stakes are like off the charts. You know, like the opposition to this is the end of everything. And isn't it a total failure in that it doesn't actually convince many people? It certainly doesn't convince swing electorate represented by several senators. And it may be blinding Democrats to kind of a gross but maybe necessary set of compromise. You could make the same line over Build Back Better as well, which again has some of the same elements. So is constitutional politics just a bad tactical move and maybe a bad normative move because it stops people from seeing downsides to their arguments?
So I guess one thing I'll say is, of course, my desired political volume is exactly 8.7, not 11. So obviously everybody should, tone their political rhetoric to exactly the level that I would prefer. But I don't think that the question of whether you're engaging in constitutional argument actually has much to do with that. I mean, if you look through some of the history in our book, at the height of Reconstruction, many dirty compromises were made. I am, shocked to inform you, if anybody is shocked by this, that a lot of compromises always get made when majorities are doing constitutional politics. The problem that the Democrats have today of being unable to pass their agenda is that they don't have enough Democrats and they're only too short. So I don't think that the volume of the voting rights debate is necessarily linked to the constitutional nature. I agree with you that they're making constitutional claims. I think in the Build Back Better, they're not making constitutional claims. The result is the same. The problem is not to do with constitutional argument as much as it just is the Democrats are in a, really messed up political situation that is partly of their own making in terms of not winning a couple more seats. I do think to the extent that there's a connection between thinking about constitutional argument and thinking about kind of uncompromising claims that, can't be, negotiated, the kind of real sort of meta point behind your examples. I think that may be a result of thinking about constitutionalism in a way that we actually disagree with. That, if you think about rights claims in court, those are often a little bit absolutist, more than they should be, as Jamal Green's book has explained. But out in politics, it's not as though we think that it's all kind of an on-off switch. You're going to lose your democracy today. It's going to become an oligarchy tomorrow. There's a lot of slow, boring work to be done to preserve the kind of constitutional political economy that we think needs preserving.
Yeah, to just sort of, you know, bring that that last point of Joey's down to earth with an example or two. What does it mean to sort of reverse the slide into oligarchy? What does it mean to reverse the gradual crumbling of good middle class jobs? Those are, you know, those are long games. Everyone understands that. And in the 19th century, the sort of equivalent debates that were seen as having constitutional stakes on both sides were similarly, in some ways, very boring debates about tariffs versus free trade, which would, you know, buoy and help undergird a broader, you know, set of kind of what they called, you know, sort of competent livings. It was at once boring and yet high stakes, but everyone understood that it took time. And we don't think that's beyond, you know, Americans' capacities, you know, today.
Then what's taken off the table? Like the question is like, if the rhetorical move is like the left or Democrats should be doing something, but it requires them to not do something that they've also seen advantage in, right? So unless you think that there's just like more space to fill up with arguments, or it's just about crafting argument, but what types of things are not available to people that they may find attractive or useful if they're going to engage in the rhetorical strategies you think they should? So again, Democrats have talked about the middle class forever. And they've made claims of that sort. It just, as you note, it hasn't been rooted in as clearly in series of like the kind of hard text of the Constitution or even the, and they've certainly made claims about American history, you know, so it's not like it, these things have been out of step, even in the period you've talked about a decline. So what do you think people oughtn't be doing? That, again, not just things that are stupid or bad, but rather that they find useful, but you think are probably a wrong move, all things total.
Well, I'll put in one. So first, I should say, a lot of what we want progressive to do is what they're already doing, but thinking about the frame around it differently. So some of the arguments about the middle class are constitutional in ways that the people making them don't always appreciate fully. And we think that seeing that continuity would be helpful and might make the arguments sound a little different, but not necessarily dramatically so. One kind of argument that I would like to see less of is the arguments from the authority of the court about the Constitution. And some of our friends argue that the problem with the court is not enough respect for precedent, and they still view the Constitution as something that courts enforce and that politicians just work within. And that kind of frame is something that I think we're arguing we should see less of.
All right. So, you know, there's so much history in this book. The trouble is that Dave is not a historian and I'm not a U.S. historian. I do want to ask to zoom in on the New Deal for a couple of questions. The first one is really just to invite you to talk about its significance in the constitutional history that you narrate. I mean, it's clear that you're right that of Franklin Roosevelt, while he tangled with the court, did not at all relinquish claims on the Constitution. And in that sense fits your vision very well, along with, you know, the other chapters in the book, which I think are very vivid and compelling. The question is, did he err in doing so? Precisely because of the large C Constitution, which you know, it seems of great significance. So, and I want to ask you, since this book will be read together in the years to come with Aziz Rana, as like I think the two major contributions to constitutional history from the left in our era to address that footnote you have about him. So, as I recall his chapter, you know, he narrates how Thurman Arnold, Yale law prof, comes to Washington and says, "Don't worry, it doesn't matter what the big C Constitution says, because we can use small C constitutionalism to just attribute anything to it." And in retrospect, it looks like that was a catastrophe, because he's wrong. And that's part of why I think Aziz wants to say, no, this big C constitution is a problem. And if we want to have small C constitutionalism, first we have to kind of overturn it and, you know, desacralize the big C constitution. So are you just, could you just talk about the New Deal and where you feel you sit relative to these kinds of dilemmas?
Okay. I think that we don't disagree with Aziz about desacralizing the court's constitution. Right? And when you actually get into the weeds, what's striking is that Aziz looks at the people who were saying, this constitution has got structural problems that are thwart, are not just the power of money in politics, but the way this old constitution was crafted to thwart popular and what both Aziz and we often call mass politics as an element of democratic governance and reform. This constitution was crafted to thwart that through the Senate, through the Electoral College, through the difficulty of amendment. And Aziz shows people like Debs, whom I mentioned before, but lots of mainstream progressives as well, pushing to change that. And what we point out, and Aziz notes as well, but we think is a lot more significant for reasons you'll see, is that those people were not saying, let's create something that's not right, that the framers and founders wouldn't recognize. They never said that. They said, the framers and founders are the ones they chose to embrace, which are pretty much the ones Joey and I do, had a set of principles about, you know, the ways in which there needed to be, you know, broad distribution of wealth, that the economy and the polity were mutually interdependent. And those principles, right, it turns out in our modern industrial world, don't work with this structure. So we change the structure to redeem the principles. That's a set of rhetorical moves that Aziz's heroes make, and they work for us as well. So that the differences on that front are not as dramatic. Aziz is telling a story we don't get into about how, you know, various corporate figures, elite figures, invented a sort of set of rituals around the Constitution and a concept of constitutional patriotism that, you know, that served their interests. But we have no problem with that story.
You know, I'll ask another question that bears on the New Deal. So the only, you know, little thing I personally have researched in what you cover is the Second Bill of Rights. I don't want to kind of empirically contest your coverage of it. It's yours is, it, I mean, you know, we know Willie, you know, was in a reading group that involved the rediscovery of that thing. And that led to its canonization by Cass Sunstein. And it's now kind of a standard part of the like liberal constitutional narrative. And I don't want to get into what I think about that narrative. What I do want to ask about you about is whether your account is nationalist. Now, this is not a comparative study, and thank goodness, because it would be, you know, multiple thousands of pages. But I think the story of the Second Bill of Rights, which comes so late in the New Deal, when its promise is on the point of expiration, is part of a larger lesson we can glean from mid-20th century American history about the persistent libertarianism of American political economy and the, you know, the inroads that progressives make in laissez-faire capitalism are less significant than other places, in fact, many other places. At this very moment, considered globally that the United States is ascending as the greatest libertarian power in world history to date. And its outward facing effects have been tremendous as a result of those developments. So I guess I want to ask, like, what's at stake in, I don't want to call it nationalist, it's methodologically nationalist, but it's let's say a left patriotic reading of American history that maybe, I wonder, as a question, if it could use some comparative perspective to get at, the weakness of the very constitutional traditions you want to exhume, which we then need to kind of like think through precisely if we support them.
Wow. Okay. I think I tracked you, Sam. But whether that sharpened the question or spread it thinner, I'm not sure.
It's a new question altogether.
I'm going to loop back and say something, short and dirty about FDR and the court backing plan. It's notoriously now seen as a failure. Part of what I think inspired Sam to say, well, wasn't that a blunder on Roosevelt's part? We don't think Roosevelt blundered so badly. We think that at the end of the day, the court packing plan was understood in the public arena of that moment of 1937 as a laying down the gauntlet to the court and the court stepping back, that it was a threat that worked. And Roosevelt may have, been sly in its first presentation, which so many people focus on today. But by and large, Roosevelt came out and said, the American people have engaged vividly with two rival ways of seeing our Constitution and the kind of freedom it protects. And they've come down squarely in favor of mine. And the court needs to wake up and smell the coffee. And that succeeded. No further New Deal measures were struck down. And the New Deal didn't get much further, but we don't think that's because of the hits he took because of the court blacking plan. We think that's because the Southern Democrats abandoned the New Deal and made a coalition with sort of corporate Republicans, and they simply stymied every further effort. And that drove Roosevelt toward a vision of a racially inclusive New Deal, which we second, not in its kind of obvious policy, not in the policies which are outmoded, but in the general vision. Roosevelt crept up on our three strands, and it's not enough just to have the political economy strands without a robust commitment to inclusion. All of that followed on the court packing plan. So we think Roosevelt, by and large, got it right. You don't promote something as seemingly discombobulating as rejiggering the Supreme Court or any other big structure to the American people just by saying, they've gotten too partisan, we want more Democrats on the court. It's a tit for tat. You don't approach it without a substantive argument about what the court and its patrons are getting wrong about our basic commitments. That's how you do it. Now, the whole basic commitments, I think that Sam is saying, hey, listen, the New Deal, sort of Second Bill of Rights, was thin gruel compared to a thicker kind of socialist or social democratic set of commitments that were mainstream elsewhere in the world. That compared, when you go into the comparative landscape of post-war global visions of political economy, it helps one see how the U.S. version, and the tradition that Fishkin and Forbath are mining, has always had a more liberal, if you want, less socialist tilt than others. I think there's no denying that fact.
I do think methodologically, and I don't know if, Willie, if you'll exactly agree with how I frame this, but I think part of why we are so U.S. focused in the book is that the book would be very long if we did not do that. But another part of it is that many ideas on the progressive left for the past century plus have come in for a kind of attack that falsely accuses them of being imports or of being only imports. And part of what we're about in this book is showing that they have a lot of American roots. Even though, of course, especially, you know, in the period that we're talking about, the late 19th century through the New Deal, there was a ton of transnational conversation going on. But we are interested in showing that in U.S. domestic constitutional politics, the ideas about needing to stop oligarchy and have a broad middle class had roots here, because we think that's part of what it is in our political culture to give progressives today permission to make those constitutional arguments again. Is to say, these are not saying, let's be more like Western Europe. You can say right. that too if you want, but that's not the only thing that this is. This is also drawing on American traditions.
I mean, in a certain way, Sam's right. We could cop to a certain kind of nationalism in the sense of appealing to a tradition, which has many transnational features, but is in the end a national tradition. Who are we as a nation? And it does rest on a view that the nation state has to be, right, supplemented by many other forms of governance, but it ain't going away. And so it's so we're fighting for the most progressive, inclusive vision of what the nation's about. We've been invited to sort of some conversation, some symposia, where we say, you should just know that the hosts think that opportunity is a word that really stinks to high heaven, right? Because it's been so abused as a, you know, as a kind of slogan and a mantra in the United States that blames sort of people who haven't clawed their way to the elite for not being there. So, and we're saying, right, but opportunity has also meant something very substantive, very egalitarian, very much about empowering each and everyone, right, to make lives, you know, that have value in their own eyes, which involves a massive amount of redistribution. So we don't think, right, opportunity goes by the boards, but it's true. It's a distinctly American, right, and in some ways individualistic, you know, way of seeing political economy.
Yeah, so this is actually where I wanted to take questions, which is, I wonder what's at stake in finding a tradition? Because you combine into a tradition a bunch of things that are sometimes aligned and often unaligned. So one thing you talk about regularly is about the need for supporting countervailing institutions like unions. And then you also talk about how the same tradition is against large firms. But often unions do best in large firms, particularly industrial era unions. And so that there's some conflicts here. And you can go through it and you can find lots of internal conflicts. And you can also find lots of other traditions, not just left-right traditions, but you can imagine slicing this particular pie in many different ways. You could talk about an urban and anti-urban constitutional traditions, or Christian and non. You could play this game all you want. And so, what I wonder is, finding this tradition a kind of extremely educated parlor trick, where you attempt to you have political commitments today, and then you kind of look around history to find, you know, the famous line about tech, you look around to find your friends, and this is just a very long, drawn out version of that, in which you have established your political commitments today, and you say, what is the constitutional tradition for people who like going to Jackson Jefferson dinners or something? Or and is that what this is about? Or is there an actual tradition in the sense that it would be recognized by all the people along your pie that they are engaged in some kind of common project for the entirety of American history?
So I'll say two things to start this one off, and I'm sure Willie will have some things to say too. I think it's not the case that the tradition that we are tracing in this book matches my political commitments anyway, perfectly. You know, if it were up to me, I have a little bit more of a 1960s view. I think that the poor deserve more focus than the middle class. You know, if I were the dictator, which thankfully I'm not, and the sort of deep middle classness of the tradition that we are sketching you know, I personally have some mild disagreements with, but I do think that you're right, that we are engaged in a project where we're trying to reconstruct what we see as the best version of a tradition that is actually there. And we're making some normative judgments along the way in doing that. I think part of what we're trying to show in the different parts of the book is that the people who were operating in this tradition, they saw what they were doing as operating in a tradition. That is, the Reconstruction Republicans were turning around and making use of the old arguments of racist Jacksonian Democrats who were nonetheless making some parallel moves about constitutional political economy. And sort of throughout the story that we tell, there are a ton of versions of that. I mean, there's actually more than we ended up putting in the book, but we put a bunch of the more interesting ones in the book where literally you can see arguments from previous eras versions of this democracy of opportunity tradition showing up again later, sometimes in transmuted form. And so that's part of what gives us confidence that there really is a tradition here. But then in part, we are making judgments. I mean, especially we're elevating the kind of reconstruction vision of bringing all three of these ideas together, bringing inclusion together with stopping oligarchy and having a broad middle class. And we're doing that in part because we think that's just normatively truer to our constitutional commitments as a nation. And as we think about them post-Reconstruction and the Reconstruction amendments that are part of our Constitution. And it's also, frankly, because we think that we have observed repeatedly and disastrously throughout several important episodes of American history that when you pull those three strands of the tradition apart, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because you end up making it too easy for right-wing populist arguments to separate the poor black and white interests and to separate people along various lines. And so we think that the tradition actually works better if you elevate the version of it that we are highlighting. But it is certainly a partly normative choice we're making.
Yeah. I would say, you know, seconding all that and trying to be much shorter, that first of all, apropos of Jackson Jefferson, you know, we wouldn't have chosen a tradition that, you know, that highlights bloody Andrew Jackson. But there
he is. Yeah, we take a lot of flack for that.
Pardon me?
We've taken plenty of flack for that.
Yeah, including from my spouse, who's merciless about it. But there it is, and the idea is that elements of that anti-monopoly tradition, of that tradition of saying that we shouldn't build up, you know, national wealth at the cost of growing inequality, are, you know, become an important part of a continuing tradition that's reached back to. So those Jackson Jefferson dinners, FDR would go to these, you know, Jackson Jefferson dinners. He was promoting something that was radically, radically different in many respects, not in terms of racial and gender oppression, but in terms of the role of government in economic life. But he would call out the ways in which the Jackson Jefferson and down to the populists, the anti-monopoly in the sort of 1870s and 80s, already rehearsed the idea that sometimes you need strong government. More and more, you know, in a corporate capitalist order, he said, we need strong government to vindicate the distributive aims that those movements thought were best achieved through laissez-faire. That there have been sea changes that require reimagining parts of this tradition, but he was very self-conscious about all of those moves. And apropos, finally, of Joey's point of 60s, one thing I feel we are better off without is the 60s, kind of the way the 60s movements were constrained, in spite of themselves, to sort of say that what the Constitution has to say about the poor is welfare rights. It's just too little. too unambitious, or as Sam puts it, not enough. And this tradition has more to say about everyone, including the poorest, that everyone needs a lot more than, you know, even a handsome welfare check.
Organic product placement. I love it. The one other question I had that's kind of along these lines is, a lot of this project reads as if it was started in an earlier period, and it doesn't have a lot to say to the kind of change in politics associated with the rise of Trumpism. So the variety of commitments, political commitments, you sound like a kind of, to me at least, or like the conscious commitments of a Democratic Party or a left in 2012 or even 2016, but not if you think that politics has been turned a little bit on its axis. And the discussion of Jackson here is perfect because the claim to Jackson here is now pretty contested. I mean, Trump famously put Jackson on his wall, a portrait of Jackson on his wall. The claims that conservatives are making constitutional arguments also is rooted in a view of conservatism that is very much of a type that is not necessarily of the type that is currently dominating the Republican Party. I mean, it's a lot of focus on the libertarianism of the opposition to your view is kind of libertarian, which is a view of conservatism, which is real and certainly was like a kind of Paul Ryan-ish type of story, is the kind of foil for your story and not necessarily a Trumpist one. So to what extent is the claim that, one of the things is like, you are making a presentist claim, this would be a good thing to do now and to speak in these terms now. And I wonder whether you're kind of, you know, like a little late.
So one thing I'll say is, I think you're right that very scary things are happening currently, and I would say not even the Trump era, but sort of the post January 6th Trump influenced era in the Republican Party is very concerning in ways that are at a slight angle to the way that the Supreme Court is concerning. And people who are surprised, oh, the Supreme Court, huh, they don't seem to be overturning elections. And yet here they are going around, you know, destroying abortion rights and, you know, using the First Amendment in a weaponized way to strike down campaign finance laws and labor law. And to actually, what I would say is the Supreme Court's conservatives are exactly the ones who are in the crosshairs of this book and who we think it's important for progressives to begin making constitutional arguments in opposition to. And they haven't moved. They are sort of just more robustly and aggressively engaging in the project that kind of drove us to write this book to get progressives to make arguments against. And so it's the conservatives on the Supreme Court who I think are fundamentally the villain of this story, if there's a presentist villain. But I also think that it's not coincidental at all that a party that is all about, you know, in its Paul Ryan version, as you sort of framed it, was all about increasing the returns for big business and, you know, cloaking this in a certain kind of populism. It's not at all surprising that that party would then endorse and put in the White House someone like Trump, who has all kinds of other traditional kind of oligarchic features, like putting all the self-enrichment and putting his children in positions of power and all that stuff, the way that oligarchs around the world do.
Right. And also continuing to deliver to the business elites by appointing more old school, anti-statist, anti-regulatory, you know, conservatives to the court and the courts in general. I mean, if the right-wing party goes beyond plutocratic populism to some, you know, more vivid kind of fascism, then it's true that in that moment, much of what this book is about will seem like something to put off to another day. But if, you know, instead it sort of rebuilds itself in a way that tries to marry a sort of racist politics and a kind of a nativist politics with a sort of political economy outlook that's much like what the court continues to stand for, which I think is pretty likely, we'll have much to say. But in the first, this is a long game. We don't expect to be, don't aspire to be in anybody's headlines tomorrow with these ideas. We'd like to be in classrooms to come back to what
book reviews.
We'd like, you know, Sam said we're all constitutional law profs here, and that's not true. But we'd like to be in your classroom too, David. Not us embodied, but these ideas, because we think over time these ideas will then move into, you know, the world of practice and policymaking and a new way of responding to the kind of the vitality of conservative constitutional political economy, you know, in debates, in court, in many different arenas. In court, just to sort of say a word since we haven't gone there, the idea that there are constitutional stakes on both sides of these weaponized First Amendment claims that over against the claim that the First Amendment or some other constitutional text condemns either regulation or redistribution, you know, is better met by a claim, not, oh no, the Constitution allows it, it doesn't say anything, is better met by a claim the Constitution, right, was on the minds of the lawmakers, the regulators who undertook this. And those kinds of arguments are lacking. And it helps to get them into the law school classroom.
All right, so I think we're going to close by kind of, you know, getting into that bright future on however long a time horizon. But I want to ask, you know, a question that is sort of redundant, but it comes at some of what we've just covered from a different angle. It's really asking about the relationship between redistribution and inclusion, or just race narrowly. You know, the kind of blunt way of putting it would be to say that, you know, Joey can say it hasn't worked, but those have pulled apart for the bulk of U.S. history. And if there's a tradition, it's a tradition of them not going together. And it just seems like a more honest narrative, you know, would look at like the progressives, you know, with Richard Hofstadter's, you know, portrait of them as, you know, paranoids, and would look at FDR's voters, whatever, you know, he did late in the day, appointing African kind of, you know, civil rights friendly judges, and say that white nationalist tradition from Jackson through the late 19th century, through the mid 20th century, is the American constitutional tradition, small c, big C, whatever. And it actually is quite difficult to envision. And there's very little American basis for combining redistribution and inclusion. And, you know, I would take that, you know, in the direction of saying we need to give up on, you know, American constitutionalism, not kind of mythify it. But that's not your tack. So explain, you know, why we should be optimistic, or why we could be, that these could ever go together, and this, given this American history that you're kind of reminding us about.
Joey, you collect your thoughts. I'll make some quick comments. One is, today is different. We mostly think of today as more dismal, but in one important way, it ain't. The past moments when FDR could afford to, right, short shrift Black America for so long, was a period in which the great majority of Black Americans were disenfranchised, were thoroughly, thoroughly disenfranchised. And when FDR swung toward an inclusive account, he did so because he saw that he couldn't carry forward, even if he wanted to carry forward the project as a white nationalist, when he was stymied. And repeatedly, that's been the case. that racial, and it ain't news. It's not like our book was needed to for that insight to sort of land, but it bears on our book. The reason it's practically impossible not to have a racially inclusive, you know, egalitarian political economy is because you get defeated if you don't. And seeing that, because of the sort of growing importance of Black voters in the North, FDR made a pivot. But today, Black Americans are enfranchised. There's a fight to re-disenfranchise them, if you want. But for the time being, they're an important voting bloc. And the racist whites have left the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's the last point. So, Sam, I think your take on the arc of American history would make many Reconstruction Republicans, including many quoted in this book, very depressed. And also, I think, would get a lot of outrage, disagreement, you know, from them projected forward. I do think, although we're not
acknowledging they had their 12 years.
Right. But it was a 12 years that I think deserves a little extra weight, given that they built our actual constitutional order in that time. And that cannot be said of most of these other periods. We, you know, in the book, we highlight a series of moments, including some of the early populists, and we show that it's not just the Reconstruction Republicans and late FDR. But I guess what I would say about today is that we do have an unusual confluence. This is the last thing that Willie was underscoring. We do have an unusual confluence today, an unusual situation that, like during Reconstruction, we have now a political party, for now, the Democratic Party, is very unusually actually committed to all three strands of our tradition. This was not true of Democrats when the Democratic Party before the Great Realignment had all these racist Southern white Democrats in the party. Today, there is an opportunity to once again reach back to the Reconstruction, more inclusive version of this tradition. And I think that matters. I think that sort of illustrates that that there is a continuing vitality to the project of drawing these ideas together. And we're mostly just trying to show that they have a constitutional dimension that today's incarnation of the Democratic Party doesn't appreciate.
And if you're going to blow up various institutions in order to get there, as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the left of those like Aziz to the left of the Democratic Party want to do, we say fine, but you need, you know, a normative, a narrative account of why you're doing so.
So I want to narrow this. I mentioned earlier that I'm unlike the rest of you. I'm not a con law professor. And one of the things I always find weird when I am in con law land is the absence of effort to empirically or normative ground claims in like kind of ordinary policy analysis. And so one of the things that I found is like you make a variety of claims, particularly in your last chapter, about kind of the relationship of big business to political influence, of the necessity of campaign finance reform, that are themselves empirically contestable. So in fact, like one wouldn't know from your book that like the campaign financing system has become much more small d democratic in many ways, in the sense that it's now dominated by small ideological donors for good and largely for ill across the system. And similarly, there's like an interesting set of debates about the political influence of businesses as they get bigger. Does being much, much bigger, in fact, make you more influential? In many ways, like big car manufacturers are less influential than car dealerships because of their greater democratic geographic diffusion and what have you. And so the question is like, to what extent do your arguments turn at all, either the kind of ways you're making arguments about rhetorical stakes, which themselves have an empirical dimension, or rhetorical moves, or alternately the actual embrace of this contested, found through history, through on like things being good or bad actually, I mean, Joey noted it's like not quite his politics necessarily. Or, you know, but to what extent do you think that in finding this history, we should care whether campaign finance law works exactly as you say it does?
So I should say, I can't resist arguing with your premise slightly, just to the effect that, yes, of course, there have been massive changes to campaign finance law, but there's a lot of different political science scholarship that suggests that even our more democratized version still is not that democratic. And we still have a lot more influence from the wealthy who can give small and medium-sized donations.
It's not quite necessarily the very largest, you know, like, again, or, and it doesn't work quite exactly as, you know, like as people imagined in the late 90s or the mid 90s when we were doing McCain-Feingold. Like, it works differently now than that.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, a lot of the story that we're telling in the book is one where the middle space where you apply the general principles to actually figuring out what policy program is going to effectuate them depends on changing circumstances. I mean, the monetary policy story that we trace in our book is kind of wild, where basically if you wanted a more democratic, more widely dispersed access to capital and money, you know, the whether that translates into we should have, you know, more gold or actually free silver or greenback. I mean, the policy valence completely flips, and some of the people in our tradition were clearly wrong empirically about what they were advocating. But the story that we are interested in is you have to have underlying constitutional principles that you then can tailor the applications of as the circumstances change. And so today's campaign finance landscape, I mean, yeah, it certainly could evolve in ways that would mean the solutions need to be different if what we want is a democratic campaign finance system that distributes power more broadly. The policy specifics of that might be in 20 years totally different than how they look now.
Okay, so I think it falls to me to ask the last question, and I'd like to, you know, ask you to sketch out, you know, a kind of hopeful future, you know, in which this book participates, you know, in even if in a small way. I mean, I think it can. It's a great achievement, and it could have a lot of resonance. And so I want to ask about that in kind of from two angles. So Willie's already, you know, put on the table that as authors, you hope that this would kind of have a trickle down, you know, effect, not in, you know, the way that David might, you know, refer to use that phrase, but
that was just mean and false. Unlike the last one, which was false, but, you know, I think generous.
Okay. So you have, you know, a pedagogical agenda, which would involve the ideas filtering out to the masses via elite law students or, you know, not so elite law students. But then I also want to, what's the promise and limits of that? And then since Willie raised it, but then I want to ask, like, where's the agent for this, you know, revivalism more broadly? Because it doesn't seem like the Democratic Party is anywhere near this. And I think, you know, the Biden administration first, you know, championed as a kind of, you know, New Deal redux, and now looks very different. I think, you know, proves that the Democrats aren't near this kind of politics, let alone constitutional politics. And so, you know, it's a long game, fair enough, but what are, you know, the prospects of seeing the Democrats in particular, you know, work not just for inclusion, which they do in many ways, but for redistribution, which, you know, they don't.
So I would add to Willie's story about, I mean, this book has a lot of audiences. One of the more narrow but important audiences we hope will pick this thing up is some staffers and speechwriters and people who work in politics nationally and state. We hope that this book will be of interest as a kind of tradition to mine I mean, you can take our quotes, you can use the ideas in here, and they can, I mean, I would like to, if you want to sort of tell a story where this book participates in a change, I feel like the, I mean, actually, Sam, I would say a lot of the progressive side of the Democratic Party is there, policy-wise, as far as redistribution. Where I'm not sure they completely are, although some of them may already be, and where we'd like to nudge them more, is in their thinking about the Constitution and in their thinking about how to oppose right-wing courts and why, and how to articulate what's wrong with what the court's doing. That it's not just, you know, this court, there was a stolen seed or two and things went wrong and now they're not respecting precedent enough and all that's true. And there may be sort of audiences for those kind of arguments, but I want people who read this book, who are writing speeches or making arguments out in politics, to be saying, this court is fundamentally building a vision of political economy that's wrong and that we don't agree with, and that's not the right one for America. The court has an agenda that that is the wrong kind of constitutional politics, and we should have the right kind of constitutional politics, which looks like this. And I think that kind of talk could be a potential consequence of, you know, of people making arguments like those that we're making here.
So, you know, there need to be more different kinds of congressional voices saying, you know, more squarely to the court, how dare you strike down, you know, or ponder striking down something like universal health care and impugning it the way even Roberts's opinions did, as a constitutional matter and a matter of constitutional conscience and responsibility. Not because that's going to, you know, redistribute, you know, wealth and power overnight, but because it'll make a difference. The other sort of small circle, besides, you know, congressional speechwriters and staffers or state legislative ones, is economics departments and political science departments, where already political economy is kind of no longer just something that libertarians talk about. It's once again becoming something that liberals and progressives in the academy, not just in the law schools, but in political science and economics departments are beginning to talk about. And that will help make it, you know, over time to various sort of professional and elite groups within our political life become, you know, commonsensical again to say you can't sort of just talk about economic, you know, economic logics and economic models. And so that's captured something hard and real. You got to think about the politics of it. And then you can't pull away the normative underpinnings so easily and the distributive questions so easily. And in that space, having learned about some of this stuff as an undergraduate or you know, a law student as a graduate student, I mean, you know, will make a difference what gets taught to undergraduates. You know, and what passes for economics. We hope to have, you know, at least a modest, very small hand in helping to change.
Well, I think it will be a fascinating discussion that we will continue to have. So I just want to thank Willie and Joey for coming on, and everyone should go out and buy this book. It's going to be what people are talking about in many departments and in many book reviews. And I just want to say thank you again for coming on. It was a real blast.
Thank you.
Thank you.